This show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Hey, it's Indie Comic Book Noise, episode 393. It's the podcast sponsored by nobody. I'm Steve Raker from the Comic Book Bunker, along with Phil up in Ottawa, Kevin in parts undetermined, but certainly north of me, and Andrew, the LA Rabbit, out on the West Coast. What's up, guys?
Good day.
I got some Valiant.
You know how long it took us to stop him talking about Valiant so we could start recording this show? On Indie Comic Book Noise, we talk about the all kinds of indie comics. Print comics, digital comics, OGNs and strips from the past, present, and even the future, thanks to the prolific Kickstarter activity of Andrew and myself. We uncover all kinds of stuff.
Well, Andrew has to get that sweet, sweet Ditko.
You can find us on Twitter on Indie Comic Book N and a Facebook page, and you can listen to us on our sister show, Marvel Noise, where we talk about all the Marvel books that we're reading. And cussing is allowed, as is moderate substance abuse, so listener beware.
But we're pretty polite.
In our substance abuse.
As I've said before, I'm not really sure who would actually be offended. I mean, I know it's not for the easily offended, but you'd have to be really fucking easily offended.
Yeah.
I mean, aside from the somewhat coarse language, like, what, sometimes we were somewhat critical of a comic book? I mean, come on, people. There's
perspective. That does set some people off.
Sometimes we might talk about, like, Archie's cheating on someone with the school teacher or something. That's going to be in the Riverdale.
Or Archie Horror let us down once again.
The problem isn't entering the portal from this side of things. The problem is entering the portal from the Marvel Noise side of the equation and getting a little taste of, oh, what's that indie noise show, and then coming on and hearing a bunch of F-bombs drop. That's who the warning is for. The warning is for the unexperienced Marvel Noise listener who might have followed us over here.
Well, I mean, I understand they may be uncomfortable that some people the podcast may record completely in the nude, but I don't think that's any reason for a warning.
We don't need details.
Well, like, it's all hot where he is. Like, I'm not going to be recording in this, you know.
In the igloo? My wife was looking at the temperatures the other day, and she said to me, oh, man, your friend Kevin up there, he's in real cold right now.
It's plus six where I am.
It's plus six where I am.
Oh, yeah, it's rained. It's been raining the last 2 days. It's been amazing. Future weather, pretty much. It's the apocalypse.
Oh.
So what indie books have you guys been reading? You guys did a show without me, so I'm like a little behind.
Well, this is actually Indie Noise's first Shark Week, I think.
Ooh,
I've got some shark books to talk about, and possibly Steve might.
Wait, so Steve, do you want us to just repeat what we did on the last episode?
Oh, we could do that quick.
No. I want Shark Week.
So I got two books about sharks I'll just go through quickly. So one is by Titan Comics. And it's one you guys might be familiar with. I wasn't beforehand, but in 1976, there's a UK company. The publisher was IPC, I believe, and the comic was called Action, which was an anthology. And one of the stories in it by Pat Mills and John Wagner was one called Hookjaw. Did you guys ever hear about that one?
No.
Okay, basically what it is it's a great white shark. And he has a big giant spear through his head, kind of. So when like he bites someone, like the hook might get them too, kind of thing.
I'm surprised you guys haven't heard of that.
Basically
he's got a tooth like in the roof of his mouth, like an additional tooth.
It sticks out pretty far though. But yeah, pretty much.
He's like the Bond villain shark.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And at the same time, like you'll hear, he even talks a bit like every once in a while there'll be a word on the page where it will say like flesh and it'll be all scratched and then stuff.
He'd be able to talk more, but he's got that harpoon stuck through his mouth.
Yeah. It's definitely weird. Like when I read it, I did not expect that's why it was called Hookjaw at all.
Okay.
And those old English comics are pretty wacky, especially the Pat Mills stuff. Yeah. I used to read a lot of the Robo Busters and all that stuff.
I think this might be where they started, too. I could be wrong. But basically this one, it starts off, and there's these marine biologists, and they're just kind of tagging sharks, you know, studying them and stuff. And all of a sudden, they're boarded by pirates. And kind of shit hits the fan. And Hookjaw doesn't really get introduced till the end, but you get to see some people eaten by him and poked by him and stuff. So I don't really know too much about Hookjaw yet, but I was pleasantly surprised. It made me, I really enjoyed it, and I probably will pick up more. I got this one free in one of my surprise comic boxes there, but I'll definitely track down the rest if I see them. And the other one I have is, I've never heard of this company, but Big Picture Comics. It says CME Presents, whatever the fuck that is. But it's a book called Atoll. Did you guys see that one?
No.
Anyone? It has these beautiful covers, which are like a homage to old horror movies. And basically what it is it starts off, there's this rich couple on their boat, kind of in the middle of the ocean, and they're banging. And the guy decides to go swimming, his wang's hanging out and everything, he's swimming with manta rays. And then all of a sudden when he comes back up to the water, the boat explodes. Then the girl, you see the girl with the sack over her head, and she's in this kind of crappy-looking building, which you later find out is on the middle of the ocean. And it's basically these guys that have these fights where they take naked people, throw blood on them, give them a little knife, and throw them in this arena in the ocean. And they have to fight a great white shark. It caught my attention, too, and I was also pleasantly surprised with this one. Usually I'm not big into shark stuff too much, but and I've been seeing shark stuff everywhere, like comics, movies. I don't know if there's a big shark boom on the way, but...
Was there a shark in, like, Jurassic Park or something?
Yeah, they got a good PR guy.
Yeah, I think so. But, these are two. I would recommend picking up the first issues after that. I can't tell you yet, but I really enjoyed these two.
To add to Shark Week here, I read White 1 and 2, which is from Devil's Due / First Comics. Like the old First Comics logo, like Chicago First Comics.
Oh, is that what it is? Because I got a few of their comics, too. I didn't know that.
It's not Mike Gold still, but other folks are involved, and it is Chicago-based, so good for them.
Okay.
Yeah, I've picked up, I talked about the one Sherlock Holmes book I picked up from the new First.
And I have a couple coming up, too, like Laura Gore I was going to talk about, and a few others.
Well, White, the first two issues, like I said, are out, and they are written and illustrated by Dan Schaefer in this kind of colorful, digital, painterly-type style. And the first issue is aptly entitled Surface Tension. You're 2,000 miles from land, 4 hours from rescue, and 6 inches from death is the tagline. There's a small plane crash over open water, and this girl survives to the surface, and she sees a few surviving co-passengers, but one by one they get pulled under, eaten by sharks.
I guess are they just floating on like random doors and things like that? Kind of?
There's just the plane itself is sinking, so they're all trying to clear themselves from the debris. And the only thing around is a small floating section of the plane's wing because the rest gets all sunk. So this girl swims over to that floating section and climbs up on it, and that's the first 6 pages. And from there, the stage is set for, you know, this is the conflict. This is the predicament. She's surrounded by sharks in open water. She does find a floating dry bag amongst like some of the debris. There's no sizable debris, but she gets a floating dry bag, and it's got a phone in it. And she's able to use that to connect to, I guess she was part of maybe a research team of some kind, or somehow she gets connected with the people who have done similar to what you were saying before. They've tagged sharks, and they can see where these sharks are around her. They're going to come get her, but it's going to be 4 hours. And she's stuck there, and there's a problem with like all the sharks like clear out, and then one big one comes, and they know that's the big one, and they put a tracer on this shark, and it's like agitating the shark, and they actually need her to try to knock the sensor thing off of its dorsal fin when it goes by because it's driving the shark nuts, all this stuff. And it's like, oh, man, she gets knocked into the water with the shark, so she's got to swim out. She cuts her leg, and she's just huddled upon this floating section of wing. It's scary. It's, you know, fast-moving. It's really good tension, and it's well-illustrated. It's been a really fun read so far. I'm digging it.
That's always been a big fear of mine. Like, I'm not too big on the ocean. I love scuba diving, but I just hate the ocean, though. Oh, scary things in there.
Yeah. I snorkel, Phil. I don't you scuba, snorkel? But yeah. I snorkel.
Oh, no. I love that, too.
I've snorkeled the Great Barrier Reef in Belize. I've snorkeled in Alaska, all kinds of places.
Wow, Alaska?
That doesn't seem Hawaii. Like your type of climate.
I'm with you, Andrew. I've snorkeled around Cozumel and various places and the Keys.
So relaxing. Yeah. Find it.
Until you step on some fire coral.
I didn't want to do the scuba because I'm like, I don't want all that gear and everything. And I'm just happy splashing around.
I'd rather be snorkeling while everyone else is taking the scuba lessons.
Yeah.
Yeah. Vacation's only so long. I had a friend that taught it, so that's why he set us all up when we were younger.
Nice. So, yeah, there's our Shark Week. How about from some of you land-bound Canadians, Kevin? What have you been reading? Anything? You just been buying, or have you been reading?
It's kind of sad. You pulling back the curtain. I was supposed to do more reading, but I was buying comics. So you can just live on comics. Hey, you can
read more DC comics.
Can't you just go to the well and pull, like, a question from Bob Carr out or something?
No, I have some comics.
All right,
most of them were Valiant comics, but regardless, I started reading this Junior Paleontologist Power Hour, a collection of comics about digging up dinosaurs. It's a cool little collection of, I guess you would call this, it reminds me of Conan O'Brien when he would make a joke and he'd be like, well, since we're mostly an educational show now, and everyone would laugh.
Wait, so are these educational comics? I need to brace myself, I'm going to learn something.
It's kind of like a bit of that entertainment and education at the same time. Because it's about someone going on I don't know if you would say adventures. Like, what do you call that when someone's there informing you about, like, dinosaurs and fossils at a museum? So you're sort of, like, on for the ride type of thing?
Yeah, they're like your narrator. They're your host.
Yeah. But it's not like
your tour guide. Your tour guide through the wonderful world of paleontology.
Like, what if you went for a ride-along, but it wasn't with the police? It was with, you know, a paleontologist.
That sounds awesome. Are you kidding?
I volunteered at an archaeological dig many years ago with my dad. We spent a few days at Cactus Hill in Virginia.
It's the Hollywood lifestyle. You've done everything, it sounds.
Andrew didn't find anything, but he lost his watch, so.
Oh. Let me tell you, it was tedious like you would not believe.
Yeah.
Because you're basically any pottery shard or arrowhead, like, bigger than your pinky nail, you had to stop and log
full
it.
Full stop.
Do you remember anything you found?
Well, I found a bunch of little, the thing was, it was a bit of a surprise site because they didn't think there'd been a settlement there as early as the evidence was finding. That's why they were so meticulous. So the most interesting thing was at lunch break one day, one of the pros that was with us, picked up two rocks, and over like 20 minutes, he made a spearhead by banging one rock against the other. And I'm like, when the apocalypse comes, that's the guy to hang out with. Like, he can make his own tools just with two rocks.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of fascinating, some of the people you meet. But the actual work was just, you know, you're just going through the dirt mark and all this stuff and find it. I mean, it was a fun experience to do, but the one thing that was so cool, I'm like, I wish I could do something like that. Like, you just bang, 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 chip, taking chips off. And at the end, he's like, they call them points because you can use them for spears or arrows or knives or whatever. But those are like the most primitive type of tool.
I thought they called them points because they're pointy.
So you're saying it's not like those, like you see all these jobs like that, especially like in Egypt, and then they'll have some live special. Oh no, we've discovered another tomb, just like that. You're saying it's, you're not discovering like full dinosaurs and everything like in 2 seconds.
There was no no Nazis, no magic artifacts.
Well, that's probably good though.
I don't know. I would have loved to fight some Nazis.
Could have been the new
Well, doctor. Andrew, I don't know if you looked out the window, but you might be able to.
Are we done with the junior paleontologist? Because
no,
got Nazis.
No, it's going to go into
I've got Nazis. This is, I can't think of a.
That's why people might be offended. Segway
City
this
for Steve.
Hold that thought on the Nazis. I'm coming back to it.
But anyhow, this guy is like leading the tour, and he's like, "Well, you can tell all this stuff by the sand and like all the different layers and everything." So he's like, "But the best way to tell is you do like this," and he starts eating some sand and some rocks and everything, and he's just like, "Yeah, that seems like grain sandstone." So then, of course, someone else, like one of the main characters that's on this tour here, they try it, and they're like, "Oh man. Now I can see everything that existed and will exist throughout all time. An endless cycle of..." And then they're like, "Oh, wait, no, never mind. That's just dirt." So there's a lot of good humor to your education here when they go into, like, what you should do if you run into fossils and stuff like that. Oh, and then...
Don't put them in your mouth.
Yeah, it's a good start. Don't
lesson
eat dirt.
Number one.
So there's a lot of cool stuff like that, and this it's stapled, but it's sort of like oversized, and it's in black and white, but it's like real cartoony. Like the characters sometimes have like the big eyes. It's like more like a comic strip type of thing, like you would see in the newspaper possibly. Like if this was a web comic, I would totally believe it. Like I didn't do any research ahead of time to see if it was, but if it was, like I would totally get that. But it's adventures in that type of thing, and then other things you'll run into, like, oh, you know, you might be camping at night, and they have some wolves here, and they're like, "Oh, yeah, well, what if we make noises? Instead of howling, we do these things to sound like a cool party's going on, so then the humans will come out, and we'll be able to get them."
So is it more the mirth and mayhem about following the exciting life of the paleontologist, or do they pull aside like little facts and stuff? Like, do they have like a little sidebar, Willis, and they give you all the information on, you know, some Australopithecus or something?
Yeah, like you might have like the character saying, "Oh, I didn't bring enough water," and they're like dying from the heat, but then like your tour guide will say, will start describing like, "Oh, small fossils from larger animals," and then they have a drawing of like the teeth, the scales.
Oh, cool.
A sort of bone fragment, and then they start like having arrows pointing out like what they're called and stuff like that. So you are learning something. It's not just mindless fun.
Yeah, that sounds like fun though. Cool.
Yeah.
Andrew, we've been waiting for you. I'll keep the Nazis at bay, so you can get a turn in. A turn.
All right.
Back.
You want What Would Phil Do or Christmas Haul?
Not Phil yet.
Okay. First thing on the Christmas list, and I know Super Steve has this book too, but the 1964 New York Comic Con, The True Story Behind the World's First Comic Convention, with a shiny Steve Ditko Spider-Man cover.
Oh.
And this was a surprise gift from my wife for Christmas about kind of what's, I guess, by their definition, the 1964 New York Comic Con is the first Comic-Con.
Oh, really?
They make a distinction to make, like, that you have to have pros in attendance and a few other rules, because there had been some fan meetups. Mm-hmm. They seem, and I guess people, I don't really care that it's the first one. I'm more interested in, I like seeing photos and kind of the history, because it's the, use of fanzines that I'm not super familiar with, and that's how the community was built, through the letters pages and then through separate fanzines. And it's an era I'm just not super familiar with the history of these people. And one of the things I love is all the pros that started in fanzines. You know, Roy Thomas being the most famous, but Mike Bossberg, who we've talked to, how many times have we mentioned him with some of his products?
Yeah. I mean, Byrne did early work for fanzines. And
he was a fanzine guy. And so it's really fun reading how, you know, they literally started out as buddies meeting up because you'd see their name and they'd put their addresses in the comic books, and then they'd form these societies or whatever you want to call them. And then they'd meet, and these couple of teenagers decide to put on the first comic book convention, and they write it up to be very dramatic. And I'm sure it was, you know, how booking the hall and things falling through and not working out. But it's worth it alone for just all the different photos of these, you know, if you like the old-timey photos and pictures of the different fanzines. Like I said, I've never collected any of them, to be honest with you, so I don't know, because I imagine it's expensive. You thought what?
I thought you and Steve would be big on those, the fanzines.
Well, you know, we rose up through the ranks in the mid-70s as youths, and so by the time we were looking for something beyond, you know, the funny book themselves, it was already 1980, you know, so fandom, you know, fandom had moved into being like indie publishers. Mm-hmm. By the time we really got into like, for me, it was almost like Fred Hembeck was like the first, like, fanzine-ish type fandom guy that I found that was like some independent person who was, you know, writing his version of essays, you know, on stuff about the comics world. And so, yeah, I kind of missed that early stapled newsletter type fanzine.
Well, I think also the publisher stuff, like you were talking about on Marvel Noise, Marvel Age was like a big, like the publishers themselves realized, why don't we just put out our own? Essentially, those were just professionally produced fanzines.
Yeah. And Amazing Heroes, right? And Comics Interview, like these were legitimate fanzines in some way, you know?
And the prominent place that Len Wein had in the first, and there was a bit of a scandal with someone accusing him of stealing someone's comics or whatever, and it's fun. What is of note is it's the only comic book convention I'm aware of that Steve Ditko went to.
Right.
So. Wow.
So he was at the first one and then never.
And there still aren't pictures of the guy.
Yeah.
Why? You guys can't, there's no pictures of him really out there?
There's the one famous photo that surfaced maybe 5 years ago that everyone circulates from from around this time. And that's the last one I think I've ever seen that's come out.
There was,
but he did the cover for the program. They include the program. They include the price list.
Yeah, that was cool.
And a lot of the materials. What's kind of fascinating to me is we kind of, aside from all the photos and stories, because one of the guys did a bunch of interviews with the, you know, Jack Kirby and all these guys. And these are, you know, 63, 64. This is early in my understanding of the scholarship of the era. So it's super fascinating to read it. But the sort of crass commercialism had already infected it. Like, you can read these kids, they're about making money and flipping the books and stuff. Like, I always think of that as a more modern thing. But they're already the second part. They have a great article from December 6, 1964, New York Times, about old comic books soar in value.
Well, you know, Amazing Fantasy 15? Like, he should have held on that. Like, instead of doing the quick flip, he should have definitely held on to that one.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure, but they talk about how they were selling them for, like, I think it was $10 or whatever. And Spider-Man was what, like, you know, less than a year old or whatever at that point. So it
I can imagine them going, should I hold this one? Or you think there's any potential future value in this one? Is this a long-term game or should I sell it right now?
So all these people were instantly flipping. The other thing that was interesting is, of course, the proliferation of original art. DC used to give it away if you took tours. So they collected a whole bunch of original art, and everyone that went to the first comic book convention got at least one page of original art for just attending.
Can not you bad. Imagine?
$2.50, I think, was the admission price or something. Oh, and Marvel gave a whole bunch of their special like prints that they had. That if you came to visit the office, they had a Spider-Man and a Fantastic Four. So a Ditko and a Kurt, and they gave those away. Tom Gill showed up, the Lone Ranger artist who did a lot of work for Dell and Goldkey, and gave a whole presentation. Fabulous Flo showed up. They had a Marvel intern that came and answered questions. And so it's kind of a fun for a guy that was not part of the era at all. It's super interesting for me. And the other thing is I just wasn't aware of a lot of research about this time period because, like I said, I had my head in the clouds about it being some kind of halcyon days of people were different, but they're really no different. You know, they're mindlessly arguing over minutiae and everything and the same complaints and people flipping prices and everything.
Well, it sounds very similar to our conventions now. Like when
just blow it out, you know, add a bunch of TV and film stuff. But they have some photos of people dressed up. But what I guess the genesis came from the fact that there were science fiction conventions way before this.
Sure.
Yeah.
That was sort of the beginning of, and then this is the first comic book one. And they had a few dealers that showed up, and they had the professionals come and give their presents. And Ditko didn't speak or anything, but he did show up, which was a pretty big get. What happened was one of the people that was a fan ended up kind of getting, he would go and visit everyone's office, and he and Steve got along well enough that he was able to invite him, and Steve, obviously a fairly private person, showed up. So I thought that was pretty great. Like, what an awesome, I mean, the kids are, some of them seem a little disappointed or whatever, but I'm like, man, that's badass. Could I got them to sign your copy of Mr. A number? Oh, wait.
Not yet.
Did he even have it created by then?
He's still a Spidey artist, but that sounds.
Yeah, he's exactly. still making Spider-Man happen. But I completely, unreservedly, if you like this era, it's a really fun book. Be forewarned is to be forearmed. The book looks huge, but the story part of it's about half.
Yeah.
The back half really is just like a copy of the program, which is, they had a 30-page program with like art and, like I said, the Steve Ditko cover and all the stuff and price lists and everything, which is all great stuff, but it's not like, oh man, I'm going to read this 300-page book. No. It's like half that. And they really, like I said, I didn't really care, but they seem meticulous to make their point that this was the first Comic-Con and, you know, try and refute arguments ahead of time and all that other stuff, which I'm glad somebody, I don't really care. Like, it seems like a really badass, cool thing for a bunch of teenagers to put on, you know, rent a hall and get these people and have it going and get Marvel to show up and DC to give a whole bunch of artwork and Gold Key to send an artist and Marvel sends an intern and Fabulous Flo, and I didn't know that she was really basically their de facto media person. Like the way they always make it seem like
she
was just
the phones.
The person answering the phone, but apparently she was also the one that just screened everything and handled all that stuff and made appearances at the show and things like that. As opposed to the way they put, I bought into the myth of them like, oh yeah, she's the one that answers the phone or whatever, but not in the same sort of way that I used to answer phones when
I was
a receptionist.
Right. She handled everything that you would need to get handled if you called. You know what I mean? She wasn't on the creative side, so anything that was the business side, she dealt with on the. She didn't just answer the phones. She also, you know, responded to and handled whatever it was. So, yeah, she was doing all that kinds of scheduling and PR type stuff.
It also made me laugh that all the boys were like, had a crush on her and everything. They're like, everyone was kind of crushing on her.
Well, in, you know, one way to think of it, like you kind of said, is, and we're so used with these tome historical, you know, prose tomes. This isn't a thing of let's write all about the old Comic-Con and then they've padded it with this other material. I kind of thought of it and appreciate it more as they reprinted that old program. and then they padded it with a little story.
That's a good way to think about it.
And it's still great, and it's not priced, you know, to be much more than that. It's, you know, it's a soft cover, magazine size type of a book, and it's cool. It's a great thing to have on the shelf for a person who's interested in the history of the medium and the personalities and stuff. I dig it.
I was somewhat tempted by the ad for that the Marvel Bronze Age Collectibles book. Did you see that one, Steve, advertised in the back?
No.
I'm like, oh, boy, yes. That's kind of curious.
Yes,
like,
I have it.
Ooh, wow, that kind of stuff always sounds like fun to me.
It
like
is.
Going through and pictures of all the stuff. Because, like I said, for me, just the pictures of all these great old creators and everything is a lot of fun, and covers and people's sketches. And
this isn't like the stuff from our youth. This is like from before
yeah.
us, you know what I mean? And the same thing with that Bronze Age toys. These aren't the toys that we saw on the shelves. This is the crap before that, which is really funny.
Which I'm sure is real high quality, because I know the toys we had were total garbage. So I can't imagine 10 years earlier they were exactly. spending a lot of money on quality packing. But yeah, all right. That was too long enough as it is. Time to find out about Nazis.
Right. So during World War II, Winston Churchill tries to get Santa Claus involved in the war on the behalf of the Allies. But Santa is adamant he is going to be neutral and stay above the fracas until the Nazis discover Santa's base of operations at the North Pole, realize what it is, and attack. They slaughter reindeer, elves, and even encase Santa in a block of ice.
Ooh.
This is Santa Claus versus the Nazis.
So this is not for kids.
No. This is from the fall of 2006. I found it digitally on Comixology. It's 95 pages, written by Benjamin Dickinson with art by Gavin Mitchell. They call their comic company Marcosa Enterprises. But this was originally published in anthology form as a part of David Lloyd's Aces Weekly web comic anthology series. And now it's together, and it really is a fun read. So with Santa taken out and the North Pole wiped out, it's up to like the last two elves who aren't captured and enslaved or put into any camps to, you know, pull themselves up by their bootstraps and gather resources and free the enslaved reindeer and then find their brethren and, if possible, rescue Santa and kick Nazi ass.
And, now, the Nazis are the bad guys, right, Steve?
And Santa's kicking ass when he comes back, if he comes back. Spoiler. But one of the things how Santa does his thing is the elves have a replicator machine that can replicate the toy after the initial design. And the Nazis get a hold of this and use it on a grand scale to create these enormous airships that, fortunately, Santa's lore also incorporates some airborne-type components and variables to be at play. So you get to see some flying sleigh going up against Nazi airships.
Dirigibles.
Exactly. It's pretty cool.
It sounds like is it like gory at all, or like,
yep.
Is the violence hardcore? Yeah, it sounds up my alley for sure.
Yep. It is gore. And it reads sideways nice on the tablet, you know, landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Good book. Santa Claus versus the Nazis.
You
yeah,
don't
I
know
thought
if
you were
going to
be talking
though,
about the Morrison Santa Claus type of thing, but this is totally something different.
Want me to talk about Claus?
You can talk about that,
yeah,
too.
I read the first issue.
Grant Morrison with Dan Mora doing the art. This was from Boom. It was 7 issues long. It began fall of 2015 and then stretched all the way to, I think, all the way like into the summer. It took a long time for these issues to get out. And then this fall in 2016, there was a Klaus Witch of Winter special. It's tough because you say Klaus Janson, but it's Claus here, right? So we got Grant Morrison crafting an original tale with lots of familiar tidings, right? He ties in loads of Father Christmas, Santa, and Yuletime lore, but a lot of it is old folk stuff, so it's not in-your-face, current, modern. This isn't fat, jolly old Saint Nick. This is like a Conan or like a Tarzan of the North type Claus.
Yeah, those are good comparisons.
He was the captain of the Grimsvig Guard, and he is kind of taken out of the picture for a while and returns to see his kingdom now ruled by this tyrant who is married to his once could have been like his love as a youth, and there's no toys for the kids, and he becomes like this Robin Hood type where he's sneaking into the city and kind of doing good deeds and helping out the downtrodden and the oppressed, among them the kids, and bringing them toys and stuff, which just ticks the tyrant off. And by the end, he's got to face his past and forge his future, and of course, battle the Krampus. It's good storytelling. It's well drawn. I really got no complaints other than the length of time it took to come out. Like you, I read the first issue and then put it down, and fortunately I waited till it was all done to reread it, and it was good. I
think the art was just beautiful too, from what I remember.
It is real nice, and the coloring is real crisp, and like his sleigh is pulled by wolves instead of reindeer, so there's this whole, you know, this Nordic aspect. It's almost, you know, like an Iditarod, you know, pulling the sleigh, the dogs pulling the sleigh. It's cool. I dug it.
Well, for me, I just have a quick update first. Last episode, I was bitching about how Space Ghost's Evil Dead just wasn't doing it for me anymore, and how, like, him not losing his hand, like, it just seems really out of character. Well, the next week, he lost his hand.
Oh,
and now he's going to have a chainsaw and everything, so maybe it'll pick up again after that. But what I'm going to talk about here is, I believe, leads into Andrew, if I'm correct. But at Zenoscope, there's been like a lot of endings lately. I haven't read Grim Fairy Tales. The last time I read it, I think it was issue 87 or 89, and not too long ago, issue 125 came out, which was a big double size issue. So I have no clue what's going on in this universe anymore. It's changed a lot. Basically, there's this team of kids. It's just like at the X-Men. Like, there's a school for the gifted, and like it's kids like Aladdin and stuff like that in there. And the main character, Celine, or whatever the hell her name is, it's her, and then like this professor type guy, like same type of character almost. And it's like I say, it's the X-Men. So it's all these characters. I have no clue who they are, what they're about, or anything. So I didn't think I was really going to enjoy it, but I actually ended up getting. Usually they don't write this good in this company, but I got really attached to the characters, and like I felt like I have read them before almost. And overall, basically, the main character, she ends up dying at the end, so she's no longer the protector of the Nexus. And it's not too bad.
Is this the new Grimm number one? Is that what you're...
No, this is Grimm Fairy Tales 125.
Oh, 125, so, all right.
Yeah, and then also they had Wonderland in the last issue. And that was one of their best series, the original Wonderland trilogy they did, and like some annuals and stuff.
Yeah.
Really high quality, and...
This I like basically... the covers.
Yeah, if you like boobs, you like covers.
Were great.
But the insides aren't like that, though, really, which is... I hate how Zenoscope does that. They kind of ruined themselves, I think, by doing those kind of covers.
Ruin themselves? That's their sales model.
But yeah, the Wonderland finale was great. It was... I haven't read that in a while either, like the series they had, but I thought that was awesome. Then they had Genesis, which kind of introduces... the new, they call it Heroes Reborn, which might be familiar. So it's like five short stories of some of the characters. And even though Wonderland ended, there's a Wonderland story setting stuff up. There's a Robin Hood one. I think Code Red. I forget what else, but an all right little anthology. And then they had Grimm Fairy Tales, the annual, which was the main character from the other Grimm Fairy Tales. It's her daughter. And it's just her and, like, kind of the school kind of learning who she is. And also they've had an Apocalypse storyline, which is them against, like, all the characters against the Horsemen of Apocalypse. And they kind of pulled a Marvel here where the event still has two issues left, but the number ones coming out now take place after. And for a small company, that's kind of bad because you'd think they would just hold off, you know, until those two issues came out. And I think that leads into Andrews, if I'm correct.
Yeah, but sometimes when I'm in the store and I'm in a hurry, I just think what would Phil buy? Because I know I can talk about it on the show, so I bought Grimm Fairy Tales number one.
So far, it hasn't been successful, what has Phil buy, I think.
And that's how I got Ginger Dead Man.
Yeah, that was dumb. That was dumb on your part.
Hey, what do you mean? That was a book. Not only was it a book I thought you'd buy, you actually did buy it.
Yeah.
So it worked out well. This is the first one is like a bunch of funny stories, and we got Joe Brucia, Ediano Silva, and Ivan Nunez. And the cover's got a chick with big cans on it.
Okay, that's the one I just talked about, Genesis, right?
No, this is Grimm Fairy Tales number one. I like is on the inside, they do tell you, okay, there's like the universe has four different realms, mm-hmm. you know, Oz and Wonderland and Neverland. And then there's a guardian, Sela Mathers, and she was killed. So her daughter, Sky Mathers, takes over. And you can tell it's a daughter because her hair is slightly different. But
this daughter came out of nowhere because.
But let me tell you,
there is nothing of her.
All these chicks have the same body, just changed the hairdo.
It's true. It's hard to tell who some of the characters are. Right?
That's why you both thought you were talking about the same issue. You're like, oh, girl, pretty girl on the cover. Yeah, is that the issue I read?
No, this is the one
issue
I
read 3 years ago from Zenoscope.
Yeah. No, the old Zenoscope was awesome because it was one and done's, and it was like based on fairy tales just in our time.
They did get very universe building-y, didn't they, with their crossovers and things?
Yeah, that's when they lost me.
But this starts with them, the two students leaving, and then like a werewolf comes out. And then, you know, the new guardian has to track down what's going on with the werewolf and uses her genius detective skills and walks along, and people wear different outfits, and then she ends up fighting wearing her kind of sexy Wonder Woman Snow White style outfit.
Because mm-hmm. they're superheroes now in this universe.
Yeah. So basically she's got like kind of like the swimsuit thing, but themed with like kind of a Wonder Woman Snow White style. And she ends up fighting the werewolf. And then just at that time, the werewolf runs off and she's chasing after him. And she can't keep up, and then, like, the wolf kills a lamb on the way and is tracking this woman down. And when he goes to strike the woman, she turns into a werewolf, too. And they end up fighting. And then eventually the sheriff ends up shooting the werewolf. But she's like, it's going to take more than a shotgun to kill him. And then she does some kind of hex whammy and puts him in a book, which I guess is the idea, you know. Sure, this all came from a book. I'm not really up on what's going on about Zenoscope.
Her powers are different than her mom's. This is a new type of book than what her mom used. So we don't really know what this book does. Like, this is kind of the first we've seen.
I don't really know what the old book does either, Phil. but they have a nice one-pager on Sela. Like, the history. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's smart to, like, introduce people to these characters and also show a lot of the covers of your comics. Because they do look best.
Yeah, and the art I thought was okay too. Like it was.
Yeah, I thought the interior pages actually were surprisingly.
Yeah, like the pages of her pretending to be the detective or whatever. I thought those were nice.
Yeah, I was just surprised that the inside wasn't as baity and switchy as we've seen sometimes in the past. But yeah, it is all like the same looking woman with different colored hair.
Yeah, like I thought
fat chicks in the Zenoscope world.
Yeah. No.
Or short chicks or tall chicks. They're all,
they're all very bad.
Buxom ladies. But, yeah, it was fun. You know, I can see that they have something there. It just feels like it's still kind of sprawling.
Yeah, like,
I think in some of that
back
thing, they should have made it, instead of just having pictures of the covers, maybe make some reason for why these are connected or why they're not or whatever. But I do think having that little intro page is totally, it does feel totally Marvel-like.
Yeah, they do.
Here's what we're doing. You know, get on board the continuity train. Choo-choo.
Where I remember seeing a bunch of the Zenoscope Grimm Fairy Tales and everything. When I was selling comics, there's another guy that, since this show was less family-oriented than another show I went to. This guy had brought out his two boxes of Zenoscope stuff. And I was just like, oh, man, he's going to be left with those. Like, who's going to buy that? But apparently he was selling them. So, you know, I guess I was concerned for his well-being when I didn't have to be. Guess who sent in another question? You can't stop this guy. Bobgar, otherwise known as Slurmo on the Twitters there.
Yay!
And he has he puts comics up on his Tumblr.
Yes!
Have you noticed that when I'm on the show, we get along with Slurmo? But when I'm off the show, all of a sudden, like, this, like, there's all bad blood, and I'm like, where did this happen? And then I come back on, and I don't get it.
I thought you said he was going to be on here at one point, and then a year goes by, and I'm like, it didn't happen.
We need to wait
for some big King Bone Press launch, when their next big...
You guys are so abrasive, that's the problem.
It'll be Ultimate King Bone, and then he'll be on here. I like the indie characters he's been drawing lately and posting, though. Because those are easy to get into the theme of this show and everything. You know, when he does that Marvel stuff or like X-Files or anything, it's like, oh, that's not true indie. We want to get indie here. So his question is, which independent comic book that is no longer being published would you like to see return? And a continuation by original creators or a reboot with new ones?
Whoa, like, can I have The Rocketeer by the original creator, or is that whole bringing back from the dead thing kind of...
No rules, yeah, you can do that.
Kind of going to be in the way.
Steve, if you bring him back from the dead, is he going to still feel the same way of the character as when he was alive?
You're right, I've seen Pet Sematary. Good, all right, go on.
See, I used
withdrawn.
To have
withdrawn.
I used to have a lot of things here. Like I would say, oh, Ruse or something. But you know, Marvel gobbled up like characters like that. So I'm like, I can't use that anymore.
That's funny because crosses my mind is although it's not going to be, it won't be my pick. But I sort of think of the Ron Mars, Greg Land, Leiston book there. The Tolkien type one, Sojourn with the Green Archer chick.
Mm-hmm. That was my favorite.
Yeah, that was good. I would have liked to seen that. I'd like to see that with the original creators. Marvel, come on, Marvel.
Yeah, or even like universe stuff. It's like, yeah, if something like the Ultraverse or getting into that type of direction, or like Image with like the Dynamo 5. Paperverse.
I love Dynamo 5. Oh yeah, that's right. Oh,
if
that's
they can
cool.
do Weird World, they can bring back some of these Malibu or cross-gen properties.
Yeah, but I'm thinking some of this stuff. I'm like, oh, this is crossing the line. So I guess I got to go with like some Image books. And in a lot of cases, like you never saw enough by the original creators. So
Savage Dragon.
I think I would want to see more of their original vision. Rather than do a reboot. Like, I would like to see more Undertow or Mercenary Sea or Arcstain or, you know, any of those.
That's what I was going to say was, for me, what my dad, before he passed away, he used to read comics just to make me happy and kind of bond with me, but he wasn't a geek at all, and even though he's the one that got me into comics. And the last one he read was Arcstain, and we really bonded over that comic, I thought. And they only made it to 6 issues, and there was supposed to be a 7th, I believe.
Yeah.
But it never came out, so I would love to see a continuation of that. It was a really weird and wacky story. The art was beautiful. And
the 7th never came out? It didn't come out in the trade?
Not that. I never picked up the trade, so I don't know. I just had the original issues.
Mm.
But yeah, I had
7. I liked how you both went,
Or I know Phil Hester had a lot of books, like they were at Image, and then they moved, it was like, what, Desperado or something?
Yeah, like Firestarter.
And then he had like The Atheist, and then he's like, well, I can't remember if that was the original name, and then they changed, or there was another name, and then they changed to The Atheist, but I don't remember if that finished, or like Stronghold. But probably the one I would really pick, and since Sixth Gun is over and it's coming back, is probably The Damned, which is like Colin Bunn and Brian Hurt.
See, I was going to say Rob Liefeld, though.
All mine, I don't think I would want to see it with a different team is the problem.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I'd want the originals.
You know, it's hard to...
I just grabbed the trade off the shelf. Orkstein collects 5 issues.
Really, wow. Wow, because, yeah, I have issue 6 in my hand right here, and it's part of that story, yeah.
Huh. See, if you were going to reboot something, I think superheroes are easier to reboot, like with different creators. Like, otherwise, some of these books, like, you just want them more by the original creator.
Well, that's one of the things that's what indie books gives us. It gives us that creator doing his character bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I don't care so much about some image like if Savage Dragon or whatever. I like that would be cool if it was by or Spawn or any of the. I guess any of the original.
If only the original creator was still doing Savage Dragon.
I know. It'll never happen.
I mean, part of it is, I think you're right about. Like, you got to really like the concept. Like, I would totally take a Whisper book by not Breyfogle or Grant or any of those guys if the team was interesting. But my two main choices, they have to be the original team. I mean, you don't want to... That's what, like Steve said, that's what made me like those stories is that original team.
You wouldn't want any more Reed Gunther by other people?
No, those weren't the two I was going to pick, but okay. That is a good choice. I like that one. No, my two are pretty obvious. I'm sure you guys can guess.
Martial Law?
Ginger Dead Man?
Martial Law, for sure, is one of them. And yeah. Another one, Super Steve should be able to guess.
Yeah, because it's mine, too. It's John Sable, Freelance, by Mike Grell. Yeah.
No, it's a it's Fat Freddy's Cat.
That was Bleed Steve there for a second.
I want more Gilbert Shelton to do more Fat Freddy's Cat.
That would be pretty great. No, I have. It's got to be Sable for Grell. Mm. I mean, it'd be so nice seeing him doing his thing. But a more modern one for me would be thinking of Ron Mars before with the cross-gen book. But he did a book with Image that there should be more coming at some point, but not yet. The first arc, it was called Shinku, and it was like a Japanese vampire action piece. Really, very. It was. I mean, I've told him it's not just lip service. That was a really, really good story and really well executed. I'm not even that big of a fan of Lee's art on. Like some of the big two stuff that he's done, like his Wonder Woman, I wasn't that big a fan of, though he's a great storyteller. But this piece, I mean, the whole thing is great from beginning to end. I really dug that and would like to see more.
I like Straddling the Line, and I would say Wildstorm, but not the...
Oh, I love Wildstorm stuff.
But possibly not the one that's coming up.
I'm having trouble thinking of old ones I love, though. Like, it's all new stuff I think of.
I feel like Warren Ellis has already, like, taken his...
Well, he's about to do it again.
I would want someone else, like, different, like, really different.
It's true, yeah. He shouldn't be doing it again.
All right. I think we shot around the horn a few times there. That can be episode 393 of Indie Comic Book Noise. Like I said, you can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, and catch us over on Marvel Noise. Drop us a line. Let us know if you've checked out any of the books we've been talking about and what you thought of them. Are we crazy?
Possibly. We'll send more questions.
Yeah, I love questions. Oscar.
All right, guys. Thanks for joining us, as always. Later.
I love digging in the dirt with just a pick and brush. Finding fossils is my aim, so I'm never in a rush. 'Cause the treasures that I seek are rare and ancient things, like Velociraptor's jaw or Archaeopteryx's wings. Now all the kids who wanna see 'em are lining up at our museum. I am a paleontologist.
that I love to try and solve. It's so fun to think about how a species has evolved, and all the kids who wanna see them can check them out at our museum. I am a paleontologist. That's who I am, that's who I am, that's who I am.
Cephalosaurus?
I am a paleontologist.